be slow and reacting. Yes, I'm here.
The clerk advises me we can proceed. Justice Jensen.
Yes.
Hey, Justice Salter.
Yes, good morning.
Justice Devaney.
Yes.
Mr. Bernard.
Yes, Your Honor.
Ms. Wenzel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, very well. This is the time and the place set in the matter of the State of South Dakota Appellee versus Cole Taylor Appellant. For the appellant, Mr. Taylor, we have Mr. Timothy Bernard, an attorney from Belle Fouche. And for the appellee, State of South Dakota, we have Ms. Chelsea Wenzel, an assistant attorney general from Peer. Mr. Bernard, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. On the evening of November 10th, 2017, the defendant, Mr. Taylor, and his friend, Austin Fichter, were invited to attend the Hairball in Deadwood, South Dakota by Ms. Melinda Roy and Ms. Alyssa Fendrick. At the time that they attended the Hairball, Mr. Fichter and Ms. Fendrick were involved in a sexual relationship. Mr. Taylor and Ms. Roy had known each other since August of 2013, and they also, or I'm sorry, April of 2013, and they also had a prior consensual sexual relationship. On the night in question, the defendant, Mr. Taylor, and his friend, Mr. Fichter, traveled from Rapid City to Deadwood and met their friends at the Deadwood Mountain Grand. They attended the Hairball concert. After the concert was over, they went to the bar, proceeded to drink, or continued to drink, for that matter. Shortly thereafter, Mr. Fichter and Ms. Fendrick returned to the party's hotel room. They had all rented a room at the Silverado, a small hotel room where all four of the friends intended to stay together. Shortly after Mr. Fichter and Ms. Fendrick arrived at the room, Ms. Roy and Mr. Taylor also arrived. The parties proceeded to take shots of Fireball whiskey, and Mr. Taylor and Ms. Roy kissed. Mr. Fichter testified that that Ms. Roy appeared to kiss Mr. Taylor back. After those two kissed, then Ms. Fendrick and Mr. Taylor also kissed in the hotel room. Shortly thereafter, getting close to, well, the parties are a little fuzzy on their time frames due to alcohol consumption, but around between 10 o'clock and midnight, Mr. Taylor, Mr. Fichter, and Ms. Fendrick decided to go out and keep partying. They wanted to go to the saloon number 10. Ms. Roy wasn't feeling well and decided to stay in the room. So Mr. Fichter and Mr. Taylor and Ms. Fendrick went to the saloon number 10 where they danced, had a good time, proceeded to drink some more. At a certain point in the night, again, time frames are fuzzy for these folks, but it appears around midnight, somewhere in that time frame, Ms. Fendrick realized that she had lost her key and her debit card. So her and Mr. Fichter went to look for those items. Mr. Taylor returned to the hotel room where he knocked at the door. Ms. Roy came to the door, looked through the peephole, saw it was Mr. Taylor, and opened the door naked. She invited Mr. Taylor in. She testifies that the two engaged in a sexual encounter. After the encounter, she got up, went to the restroom, came back, and got into bed with Mr. Taylor while still nude. Shortly thereafter, Mr. Fichter and Ms. Fendrick arrived back at the hotel, knocked at the door. Mr. Taylor answered the door with his shirt off, let them in. He then went and got back into bed with Ms. Roy. Mr. Fichter and Ms. Fendrick engaged in sexual intercourse in the shower, just a few feet from where Ms. Roy and Mr. Taylor were in the bed together. Ms. Roy then claims that at some point in the early morning hours, Mr. Taylor attempted to have sex with her again. She said that she couldn't because she had a boyfriend, so that encounter ended. Mr. Fichter and Ms. Fendrick testified they never heard any commotion or any struggle. There's never any evidence of any marks on Ms. Roy. The next morning, the mood in the room was good. The friends laughed and joked about parting too hard, and then they parted ways. 2 days later, after Ms. Roy and Ms. Fendrick had discussed what happened with Mr. Taylor in the hotel room, and Ms. Fendrick, who was friends with Ms. Roy's boyfriend at the time, encouraged her to turn Mr. Taylor into the police, a report was made on November 12, 2017. Now, at that point, an indictment was filed charging one count of second-degree rape regarding Ms. Roy and one count of attempted second-degree rape regarding Ms. Roy. A jury trial was held, and Mr. Taylor was found guilty of one count of second-degree rape and not guilty of attempted second-degree rape. He received a sentence of 50 years in the state penitentiary with 20 years suspended. Now, although there was a jury trial held in this matter, it was not a fair trial. Mr. Taylor was deprived of his right to a fair trial on several grounds. First, the trial court erred and allowed 404B evidence of a prior acquitted act to be admitted against him.
Mr. Barnard, let me ask you about the 404B issue.
Yes, sir.
How many witnesses in the trial were 404B witnesses?
Your Honor, off the top of my head, I believe that there were seven or eight were 404B witnesses.
Was that more than half of the total witnesses for the state?
It was more than half of the state's total witnesses, Your Honor, and more than half of the state's, I believe it was roughly half. I obviously haven't done a word count on it, but the state spent almost half their time on 404B in this matter.
It was a three-day trial or two?
Your Honor, it was a two-day trial.
And you'd say about a day of it was 404B evidence?
Yes, Your Honor, approximately.
Okay.
So, Your Honor, and that brings me to, we'll just jump right into the 404B issue, because I feel that is one of the highest levels of error that was committed in this case. Now, I know the state argued that somehow the defense had waived 404B in this matter. There had been a suppression hearing held on the 404B. Briefing was done. The trial court ruled in the state's favor on that. Also, at page, jury trial volume 2, page 225, the defense specifically objected to all 404B in this case. But, Your Honor, in regard to Portia Radke, which I feel is the much more egregious 404B, just based on the fact that it was an acquitted prior act, and Lawrence County Criminal File 1447, Mr. Taylor had been charged with second-degree rape regarding Ms. Radke. Now, Ms. Radke testified at that trial, and a Lawrence County jury acquitted Mr. Taylor of that second-degree rape. He received a judgment of acquittal, and pursuant to the law in Dowling versus United States, 110 Supreme Court 668, to admit that evidence violated several doctrines, the Due Process Clause, Fundamental Fairness, and Collateral Estoppel. As the court knows, collateral estoppel prohibits the government from relitigating an issue of ultimate fact that has been determined by a valid and final judgment. Now, in this, yet the state offered Ms. Radke's testimony regarding specifically that prior rape allegation and the facts surrounding it as 404B evidence in this case over the objection of defendant, thereby forcing the defendant to relitigate the rape allegations against him. He had been acquitted of those violations, and for the state to offer them again violated double jeopardy, fundamental fairness, and collateral estoppel. Those facts had already been heard and determined to not be valid. Ms. Radke got up at the state's behest and proceeded to testify that she was raped and that the allegations surrounding that rape, which had already been heard and decided by a Lawrence County jury, were in fact true. The state called the officer in the case as well to testify in regard to that prior 404B acquitted act. As stated before, it's a direct violation of the law set forth in Dowling versus United States. And I believe that this court should follow that holding in regard to a prior acquitted act used specifically regarding an issue of ultimate fact that's been decided by a jury and determined by a valid and final judgment, which it was in this case. The trial court, however, did allow that to be introduced in front of the jury, and to do so was error and reversible error, Your Honor. There was also evidence of a dismissed prior act regarding Ms. Brooks, who was another 404B witness. The court, I believe, had it conducted the proper balancing test, would have found that that evidence should not have been admitted either. It was too remote in time, and also, even if it could be considered relevant, had been dismissed due to credibility concerns and third-party DNA being found in Ms. Brooks that was unrelated to Mr. Taylor. Now, with the state spending so much time on 404B in their case, it became evident that it wasn't being used for a limited purpose, as is provided by the statute. Instead, it was being used by the state improperly to show character and propensity to commit a crime in violation of the rule under 404B. And the trial court actually even stated that she was concerned that, you know, the defendant was being forced to try another case, two other cases within a case, and directed the state to move on several times. But the state relied very heavily on 404B, so much so that they really didn't present any evidence that an actual rape had occurred beyond testimony from Ms. Roy. There was no physical evidence that a rape occurred, and their own expert, Tiffany Petro, who tried to testify to the fight, flight, or freeze theory in regard to why Ms. Roy didn't have any marks on her, didn't show any signs of a struggle, was that she froze. She equated it to being attacked by a bear and freezing, at which point the defense asked, well, okay, but if you get attacked by a bear and you have an opportunity to get away, why would you go back to the bear? Like in this case, why, if Ms. Roy was actually raped, did she get up, go to the bathroom, and then come back and get into bed with Mr. Taylor naked and stay in bed with him all night?
Mr. Barnard, excuse me.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, you know, often that is the case in rape cases where the primary issue is consent, and that was whether or not she consented. And often it is a he said, she said type of scenario. So my question is your primary issue with regard to the other act evidence, and particularly with regard to the one that went to trial and was acquitted, was the fact of the prior acquittal? Because do you concede that there is relevance to a prior act if the similar circumstances are established to rebut the defendant's consent claim?
Your Honor, I think the relevance issue is always the broadest prong of the 404B test. So I mean, when we're looking at relevance, I mean, I think that it's hard to argue that it wouldn't be relevant in that perspective. So, but that being said, just because it's relevant, it's a prior acquitted act. So I think when you take that next step that it's a prior acquitted act, I don't know if you can even get to the relevance prong anyway, because it's already proven to be, well, there's an acquittal showing that it was untrue. I mean, those facts.
Mr. Bernard, I don't know if I can let that one pass. I don't think that's what an acquittal is about, is it? It's not a finding that something didn't occur or the facts didn't happen. It's different than that, right? I mean, they weren't proven sufficiently under a criminal burden of proof. So I don't know that you can make that leap, can you?
Well, I think, and I'm glad that you asked that question, Your Honor, because basically I feel like the presumption everyone's operating from is just because he was acquitted, it's almost like the state and the trial court assumed, well, he was guilty, just not quite guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. You know, if there's no preference to breach that leap, I mean, and if you're going to go that way, I feel there's much more evidence that he was presumed innocent and he was found innocent when he was acquitted. And I think where you actually have dealt in this case with the 404B evidence that was actually a prior acquitted act where this exact testimony was given and heard and an acquittal was entered, I feel like it's not near as much of a leap to say he's innocent and not because he was found not guilty than to try to give the state this presumption that, yeah, he was guilty. It was just slightly less than beyond a reasonable doubt.
Two thoughts on that. It seems like, one, if that's your argument, the real objection you have is to the rule that allows it at all, right? I mean, if that's the case, because that argument could be made and has been made undoubtedly in most or all cases where acquitted or dismissed conduct is admitted under 404B. So I'll let you respond to that, because it seems to me like then that's just challenging the rule and whether it's a good rule or not. But the second point I was going to make is that it seemed to me like you were able to not only argue, but also cross-examine and through the adversarial method of trying a case, talk a great deal about the prior acquittal. That was very much in front of the jury. So just those two thoughts, if you want to react.
Yes, Your Honor. I think it's important to distinguish between an acquitted prior acquitted act and a prior dismissed act, because when you get into prior acquitted acts, the bar is higher for those to be allowed as 404B versus a prior dismissed act. And I think that's an important distinction to make. You know, whether or not I agree with 404B evidence, that's why there's a balancing test there. I just feel that when you apply Dowling and the rule regarding prior acquitted acts on specific factual scenarios, that the testimony regarding Ms. Radke should not have been admitted. I feel that.
Mr. Barnard, I want to ask you about, you cited the Dowling case and you talked about that a moment ago.
Yes, sir.
It seems like Dowling kind of cuts against you. Tell me why you think Dowling favors your standpoint. I mean, that was a case where the court said that a previous acquittal, that evidence could come in. Why does Dowling help you?
Your Honor, because Dowling prohibits relitigating an issue of ultimate fact that has been determined by a valid and final judgment. And Your Honor, that's why, although when that standard is applied, the state with Ms. Radke forced us to relitigate an issue of ultimate fact that had been determined by a valid and final judgment.
2 minutes, counsel.
I'm sorry.
2 minutes left.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. So that being said, yes, we did. Obviously, I filed suppression motions regarding the 404B evidence, and I did everything that I could to keep that out. But at trial, we did conduct cross-examination. The next issue I wanted to jump into was that there were lab reports admitted in violation of the Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause. The state relied on SDCL 23.3.19.3 to introduce affidavits. However, they did not contact the defense about getting a stipulation agreeing to those affidavits being entered. This defense objected based on Foundation Confrontation Clause issues. The trial court initially got the ruling right under State v. Beck and sustained our objection. However, after the state produced the statute without conducting the required testing under State versus Beck 2000 South Dakota 141, this trial court admitted the lab reports and ultimately a ruling that they had right actually made error. And it's error that under State versus Beck is reversible error. Under the Confrontation Clause, the court was supposed to balance my client's rights of confrontation against the state's need to present this testimony.
Mr. Barnard, can you just explain how you were prejudiced by the error that you allege?
On the Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause, because I didn't get to question any of the experts regarding the DNA. The DNA that was used wasn't even seized in this case. And at that point in the case, we'd made no argument that anything was consensual or not consensual. The whole issue was still up in the air of whether any act actually did occur. Once the state overruled us, or once the judge overruled us and allowed that evidence to come in, it had to change our trial strategy to some extent. That was one of those issues where the state failed to do their due diligence. It's not my job to do it for them. The trial court shouldn't have bailed them out.
Your time has expired.
That was a pivotal moment in the trial.
Your time has expired. Thank you. Ms. Wenzel, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. First of all, I'd just like to say what an honor it is to argue in front of this court. I've been looking forward to this day for a long time. This isn't exactly what I imagined it would look like, but I'm very excited to be here nonetheless. So in this case, what started out as a girls' night out between two friends quickly turned into a nightmare for one of them. In November of 2014, MR and her friend AF attended a concert in Deadwood. AF had two extra tickets to this concert, and she offered them to her friend Austin, who in turn brought his friend Cole Taylor along. Cole Taylor is the defendant in this case. Both AF and MR knew Mr. Taylor and had been around him a few times before this night. So the group, once together in Deadwood, socialized and drank at a bar, and then they headed back to MR and AF's hotel room, where they continued drinking. While they were at the hotel room, defendant held AF in place and kissed her. AF immediately got up and walked away. Later on, defendant was outside talking with MR, and he leaned in and tried to kiss her as well. MR stopped him. She was surprised, and she said, "I have a boyfriend. I don't want to mess anything up." Later on, Austin, defendant, and AF wanted to go back down to the bars in Deadwood. After having too much to drink and feeling ill to the point of vomiting, MR decided to stay behind and go to bed. Now, while AF was dancing at one of the bars in downtown Deadwood, defendant came up behind her and he put one hand on her breast and the other on her vaginal area. AF immediately walked away and told Austin. Austin then went up to defendant and told him to knock it off. Defendant said, "My bad, my bad." And then he threw a temper tantrum and sat by the bar by himself. Now, once the bars closed, defendant headed back to the hotel room before AF and Austin. MR, who was sleeping in the hotel room, said that she heard a knock at the door and she heard someone say her name. So she got up and let them in, and then she jumped back into bed. Now, MR realized it was defendant who she let in when he crawled into bed with her without any clothing on, flipped her over on her back, and put himself between her legs. Defendant had an erection and penetrated MR vaginally. MR told him to stop and tried to hold him back with her arms extended on his hips, but she was too weak to do so. MR was crying and hyperventilating and having a panic attack. Now, at one point, MR was able to grab the side of the bed, flip herself over, and try to crawl away from defendant. And she got away from him for a few seconds. However, he then grabbed her by the hips and penetrated her anally as she hung off the bed. Defendant then pulled her back on the bed grabbed her by the back of their by the back of her head as he knelt by her face and tried to shove his penis into her mouth. MR kept her teeth shut and again told defendant to stop. But defendant didn't stop. Instead, he flipped her back on her stomach and penetrated her anally and vaginally until he ejaculated. MR then passed out. Now, defense counsel would like this court to believe that this case is just an unfortunate he said, she said situation born out of a drunken night and a regretful next morning. However, this is just the latest instance in a pattern of sexual assaults where defendant intentionally targets a young woman he knows and capitalizes on her vulnerabilities to get her alone and fulfill his specific sexual desires. So in this case, defendant was charged with second degree rape. Before trial, defense counsel filed a motion and notice of his intent to use evidence of a previous sexual encounter between himself and MR to show that the sexual activity in this case was consensual. In response, the state filed a notice of intent to use 404B evidence, identifying two previous sexual assaults to show defendant's pattern, plan, intent, motive, and lack of mistake, and also to address the material issue of consent. This first 404B assault occurred in November of 2014 with PC when she was 19 years old. Defendant knew PC and used his relationship with PC's boyfriend and an apology ruse to gain access to PC's dorm room. Once alone with her, defendant sexually assaulted PC and held a pillow over her head to muffle her screams. Defendant vaginally penetrated PC, tried to penetrate her anally, and then forced her to submit to oral sex. Defendant threatened to record the oral sex to show that PC consented. PC said she would scream to show that she did not consent, so defendant elected to penetrate her vaginally until he ejaculated. The second assault occurred in December of 2014 with TB, who was 21 at the time. Defendant established a friendship with TB, who, because of a brain injury, suffered from noticeable verbal, cognitive, and physical limitations. Defendant used this friendship to get TB alone and away from her phone, which, due to her limitations, rendered her unable to defend herself. Once alone, defendant first vaginally penetrated TB without her consent, and then he anally penetrated her after she said no and told him to stop. Finally, defendant forced TB to kneel and perform oral sex so he could ejaculate on her face. After a pretrial motion or pretrial hearing and briefing, the trial court granted defendant's motion and the state's motion for 404B evidence.
Ms. Wenzel?
Yes.
Excuse me. You know, maybe if we could zero in, it appears that Mr. Barnow's primary issue here that he's raised is the prior acquittal of the defendant with regard to the first other act witness, and his suggestion that there should be a higher bar there and that it wasn't met here. Can you address that, please?
Yes. So first, to set the stage and the context for that, I would like to discuss Mr. Barnow's use of Dowling and Ashby Swenson to argue that this acquitted act was a violation of his of the double jeopardy clause, because I think that's where his basis is for arguing that there should be, for some reason, a higher bar. So in Ashby Swenson, the United States Supreme Court found that the double jeopardy clause incorporated the doctrine of collateral estoppel in a very narrow situation. So in Ash, we have a case where a group of masked men robbed six men playing poker. So in Ash, the defendant was acquitted of robbing one of the men playing poker. Then defendant was tried and convicted of robbing a different poker player in that same instance during the same robbery and same criminal episode. The court in Ash held that the acquittal in the first trial foreclosed the second, because in that case, the acquittal could have only meant that the jury was unable to conclude that defendant was one of the robbers. Now, the United States Supreme Court rejected defendant's argument in Dowling v. United States, as you alluded to, Justice Jensen. That is not what the court held, and what the court held in the Dowling decision is not in defendant's favor. There, the court found that the double jeopardy clause did not apply. And the same is true here. Unlike in Ash, there's no claim that the acquittal at PC's trial conclusively determined whether the defendant raped MR 4 years later. Instead, the issue is the admissibility of the witness's testimony. And the Supreme Court found that the introduction of relevant evidence under 404B, even if it's based on acquitted conduct, is not the same as charging and prosecuting the defendant again for that conduct. 404B is other act evidence, not other conviction or other charge act evidence.
Ms. Winslow, what about this case where I understand the way you're explaining the rules, but in this case, it looks like roughly half or nearly half of the witnesses that testified in this trial related to other acts evidence. And if I'm looking at it right, many of them were sprinkled in among the witnesses that were connected to this case. You know, this is a discretionary, or this is an abuse of discretion review for us. But at some point, does that eclipse the point of prejudice and we wind up having two simultaneous trials? And if that's the case, there may be no hard categorical rule, but what are your thoughts about whether we're there in this case?
So by my count of the 14 witnesses in trial, five of them were the 404B evidence. We had TB, her father, the cop from TB's case, PC, and then the cop from PC's case. Of the 312 pages of the actual trial, not voir dire, 182 of those were testimony from witnesses not related to 404B, and 66 pages were 404B. So it's considerably less than half, as defendant argued. And here, you know, as this court has said, all evidence offered by the state in a criminal trial is likely to be harmful to the defendant's case. But kind of, as you alluded to, Justice Salter, it, you know, the question is whether it's unduly prejudicial. And this court has defined that as persuading the jury in an unfair, illegitimate way. And you guys, and this court has identified four safeguards that have to be followed in order to keep the evidence from being unduly prejudicial. Here, those four safeguards were followed and actually exceeded by the trial court. And that is what kept this case from being unduly prejudicial. First, the evidence has to be offered for a relevant purpose. Here it was. Consent was a material issue. Defendant was claiming consent. So he opened the door in that way to one of the relevant issues. Second, the court has to weigh the probative value of the evidence versus the prejudicial effect. Here, the court found that the evidence was probative because defendant was arguing consent. And the court balanced it and found that the prejudicial effect did not outweigh the probative value of the evidence. Next, when requested, the court instructed the jury of the limited purpose of this evidence. And finally, the court also instructed the jury that to consider this evidence, they had to find by preponderance of the evidence standard that the acts occurred and defendant was the actor. So with those four safeguards, this court has determined that that's how we keep evidence from being unduly prejudicial, and that's why it was not unduly prejudicial in this case. And additionally, the court monitored the evidence at trial. The defendant was able to introduce evidence of a prior sexual encounter. And as you pointed out, Justice Salter, he had the full opportunity to cross-examine the witnesses, and he told the jury about the acquittal and the dismissal in this case. Does that answer your question? Okay.
Could you address, Ms. Wenzel, the issue of the lab, the DNA report coming in, and what, if any, prejudicial effect? And is the state conceding the confrontation issue here?
So first, the state is not conceding that there was a confrontation error. So in Melendez-Diaz v. Massachusetts, which is the United States Supreme Court case, the court suggests ways for the introduction of reports under certain conditions. So reports like in this case, under certain conditions. Here, unfortunately, the record is not developed enough to know whether those conditions were met. So the state therefore can't or doesn't, the state takes the position that if there was any error, it would be harmless. And it would be harmless for four reasons. And there's no prejudice for four reasons. First,
before you get to prejudice, I just had one question. And I do want to hear your prejudice argument. I'm sorry to interrupt, and I'll let you get back to it. But would you at a minimum acknowledge that the procedure in 23.3.19.3, which predates Crawford, has to comply with Crawford? It doesn't appear, maybe you have a different thought, it doesn't appear to be what Crawford and Melendez-Diaz and Bullcoming might consider to be a notice and demand statute. But maybe you think it is. And I want to hear your prejudice argument. But before we get there, I'm just curious about what's your idea about that statute?
So the statute is not, I wouldn't say that it's exactly what the state or the court was talking about in Melendez-Diaz. But the court was just offering kind of hypothetical examples of what statutes need to look like in that notice and demand. And there's, you know, this court has said that there's a presumption that the statutes are found constitutional. And there's a way to make or to ensure that the statute in question is constitutional. And that would be by following the factors announced in Melendez-Diaz v. Massachusetts. And so that's what I was saying is that, you know, the record is not developed enough to know whether there's adequate notice and demand. So that's why we're taking the position of harmless error. So again, there's four reasons this was not prejudicial. First, the defendant's identity was not at issue in the previous assaults. So the reports identified defendant as the DNA found in TB and PCs and PC. But since defendant's identity was not an issue, then this wouldn't have affected the jury's verdict in any way. PC and TB both knew defendant before the assault and identified him as the perpetrator at their trial. Second, defendant had a full opportunity to cross TB and PC regarding their testimony, and he didn't dispute that he was, in fact, the source of DNA found within their evidence. And third, the reports were part of 404B evidence. And as I explained,
My recollection with regard to the cross-examination on TB is that the defense counsel actually used the report and got the asked a question about, wasn't it true there was some unidentified DNA found in her tested sample? Is that accurate?
Yes. So in the testing, there was more than one source of DNA found. But again, defendant didn't dispute that he was at least one of those sources. He was just saying that there is an additional source found as well. So next, the reports were part of the 404B evidence. They're offered for a limited purpose, and they represented a minute portion of the evidence at trial. So as I said, the 404B evidence was considerably less than half of the evidence used at trial, and these reports were just a portion of that 404B evidence. And finally, notwithstanding the 404B evidence, the jury heard MR and AF testify at length about the events of the night and the defendant's behavior. The jury heard MR's graphic description of how defendant raped her in the hotel room. They heard testimony about defendant's temper tantrum after being told to stop, and an expert explaining how victims act after traumatic events. So looking at those four considerations, this court could find and should find that if there was any error in admission, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt and did not affect the jury's verdict. So at this point, if there are no other questions, I would rely on what I argued in my brief, and I would ask the court to affirm the sentences and the convictions in this case.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Wenzel. Mr. Bernard, you have 10 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. In regard to the reports, the lab reports, each of those is a witness. It's disturbing for me to hear the state discuss them as just reports. Each of those is a 404B witness and a witness in this trial that we were not able to cross-examine. And those need to be added to the 404B witnesses as well. And that's the problem with SDCL 23319.3, which on its face is unconstitutional. But even if it's not, this court, well, and this court has dealt with this statute in State v. Beck and specifically put in a balancing test to deal with these issues, which none of them are followed. That's why when the state says, well, there wasn't enough of a record to decide if this statute was followed, well, it's because it wasn't. There was no balancing test done. My client's constitutional confrontation rights were never even considered by the trial court. Originally, the trial court got the ruling right and kept them out. However, without reviewing the statute in more detail, the trial court allowed the reports to come in. The statute specifically...
Mr. Barnard, I want to follow up with the question I asked Ms. Wenzel. With regard to TB, it appeared to me that, and this is on the prejudice question, that defense counsel actually made some hay out of that report and used it to suggest, or not to suggest, but pointed out that there was an unidentified individual or that contributed to that sample, and then also followed that up by, isn't that one of the reasons why this case was dismissed? So, you know, to that extent, it did appear that the defense counsel was able to some extent use it to his benefit.
You know, and Your Honor, I guess in that situation in trial where it's been admitted, I've objected, and I guess the approach or the strategy decision there is, you know, you can't just lay down and give up. You still have to try to win. And I objected to it coming in. It was allowed in, I believe, improperly. But once it's in, it's in. And I still have to do everything I can to win the trial for my clients. So I did use it once it was already admitted over my objection, yes. Your Honor, in regard to State v. Beck and the Sixth Amendment, dealing with those lab reports, the court is familiar with that test. They're familiar that there was no balancing test conducted by the circuit court in this matter, that the lab reports initially were not going to be admitted. However, the trial court incorrectly reversed that decision, allowed them in.
And as I mean, we wouldn't need Beck, which is a 2000 case prior to Crawford. I'm trying to understand your argument. We wouldn't really need that if the procedure violates Crawford, whether there's balancing or not balancing. I think, as you said earlier, there would be a confrontation problem with treating that as dispositive evidence. But did I hear you correctly on that?
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, 23319.3 on its face is in direct conflict with Crawford and unconstitutional. Really, all it is a, when you read it, the effect of it is just that the state is free to go to the defense and ask for a stipulation to admit these reports without calling the experts. And I guess the defense can always agree to that, as they can with any stipulation. However, there's really no requirement on the defense to do so. And
you wouldn't view this as a notice and demand procedure?
I guess it doesn't appear to be, Your Honor, and there was, and if that's, it needs to be rewritten if there's going to be, I guess.
Okay, I understand.
Now, I know, and that brings me to my next point, Your Honor. I know you were talking about, and I believe what you were alluding to is cumulative error. And my argument is that...
Mr. Barnard, before you get to the cumulative error, I want to ask you about the state's argument was, you know, our case law has four safeguards under 404B. If the evidence is relevant, if there's balancing under 403, if it's a limited purpose or a limited instruction is given, and a preponderance of the evidence instruction is given under the abuse of discretion standard, we affirm. Respond to that in this case in the context of these facts.
Well, Your Honor, we're dealing with a situation here on a prior acquitted act where that exact factual scenario was heard and decided by a final judgment. When I believe that has to be weighed into the 404B in regard to relevance and undue prejudice. And yeah, Your Honor, I think as well, when you look at the scope of the 404B in this case, it went way beyond the scope, so much so that even the trial court acknowledged that, that we were trying cases within a case and the 404B evidence was far beyond what she wanted and directed the state to move on. But back to the actual 404B application, Your Honor, I understand the balancing test, but more weight needs to be given to the fact that it's a prior acquitted act and the undue prejudice from reintroducing a prior acquitted act and forcing the defendant to try that case all over again.
So does that ultimately put it back on the trial court? And as an appellate court, it's not for us to say, oh, the court should have put more emphasis on prejudice or shouldn't have emphasized relevance so much. I mean, is that our prerogative on appeal to do that, abuse of discretion?
I'm asking you to, because I feel that, or based on it being a prior acquitted act, it has to be looked at differently. We're not talking about a prior dismissal. We're talking about a prior acquitted act that determined this exact factual scenario that was offered as 404B. So, and with all that cited, that's where I enter into the cumulative error argument, which when you look at everything, the state doesn't even argue that the Sixth Amendment confrontation clause was violated. And they acknowledge that no balancing test took place and the statute wasn't complied with. And that's reversible error. But when you look at the 404B issues, the Sixth Amendment issues, the witness misconduct by the state's witness, who Ms. Fendrick, who sat out in the hallway and coached Mr. Fichter prior to him coming in to testify, the court denied the motion for a mistrial regarding that as well. But when you take all those together and look at this full record and how much time and energy was spent on the 404B evidence at trial, not just at trial, but in this argument, the state took up a substantial amount of their time just talking about 404B, the facts of the 404B. I mean, Mr. Taylor didn't get convicted on the evidence against him in this case. The state misused that 404B evidence to destroy his character and show a propensity to commit crime, which isn't allowed.
2 minutes.
Counsel, do you want to make a few comments regarding your Eighth Amendment issue? Your client received a lengthy sentence.
Your Honor,
I'm going to have to interrupt here. The state doesn't have an opportunity to respond to that.
And I was just going to rely on my brief for that one, Your Honor. Mr. Taylor was deprived of his right to a fair trial. The state's asking this court to engage in a result-oriented application of the law, specifically in regard to the lab reports that were admitted in violation of the Sixth Amendment. To do so would result in a grave injustice to Mr. Taylor. And I just want to remind the court and the attorneys involved and anybody listening that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We're asking this court reverse the conviction of Mr. Taylor in this case and remand this matter for a new and a constitutionally fair trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes and then we'll proceed with the third.